Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order Monday, March 15th, 2010. Got a variety of bills on the agenda. I'm not seeing Senator Erickson Ropes, so we will take Senator Scogan, Senate File 2604. Senator Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We have before you Senate File 2604. Current law, members and Mr. Chair, requires that a newly permitted facility that turns waste into energy through incineration has to test for mercury emissions on a quarterly basis for 3 years. If the results show that the emissions are less than 50% of permit levels, then testing after that need only be done on an annual basis. This bill reduces the quarterly testing requirement to 1 year if the new permit covers only an expansion of an existing facility and mercury emissions are 50% below the permit levels during the first year of quarterly tests. The bill is going to cover two new expansions, Olmsted Dodge and Pope Douglas, as well as any future expansions. Anybody who was looking at the bonding bill saw that there was also a expansion scheduled for Perham, which is a four-county consortium. Current operations at the two new expansions operate at mercury levels far below that 50% of their 60 microgram permit level. The PCA is not expected to oppose this change, but I do have a few people who would like to testify today, Mr. Chair, and they could explain how this particular bill might help them in their expansion of turning waste to energy.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is John Helmers. I'm the solid waste manager for Olmsted County, and I represent the 62 employees in our solid waste division. I'm a professional engineer licensed in Minnesota and worked in solid waste management for 17 years of my career. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee regarding the modification of Minnesota Statute 116.85, Subdivision 1A. Dodge and Olmsted counties have, over the last 24 years, built and expanded an integrated solid waste management system, which properly manages solid waste generated in Dodge and Olmsted counties. As most everyone knows, there's no single solution to properly managing all types of waste produced in our communities. By using an integrated system, all types of waste can be disposed of in the most environmentally beneficial, safe, and economic manners. Our integrated system includes waste management practices such as reduction and reuse of waste, recycling and marketable materials, composting of yard waste, resource recovery by mixed municipal solid waste combustion and energy recovery, and finally, land disposal in a modern, properly engineered landfill. The best way to deal with mercury is to get it out of the waste stream, and we are appreciative of the previous legislatures who mandated removal of mercury from consumer products. To deal with old products that exist in our homes and businesses and ultimately end up as waste to be disposed of, the Olmsted County Integrated Waste Management System includes a hazardous waste facility that collects known mercury-containing items such as thermometers and thermostats. We also provide education about mercury and other hazardous waste that should not be put into the mixed municipal solid waste stream or the regular garbage that commercial haulers pick up. To date, our facility has collected or removed over 1,300 pounds of mercury from the waste stream. Because we know that not everyone uses the proper place for all their waste, the Olmsted County Waste Energy Facility also has pollution control equipment to remove as much mercury as possible. We do this by lowering the temperature of the flue gas through the acid gas scrubber to a point that mercury becomes condensable. Then the flue gas is injected with powdered activated carbon, or PAC, so that mercury can be collected in the baghouse filter. The resulting environmental monitoring we have conducted over the years, the results of environmental monitoring have shown that the OWF safely controls 98% of the mercury that's in the waste coming to the OWF. Currently, the facility emits less than 4% of the amount that's allowed by our permit. In 2009, the MPCA, based on Minnesota Rule 7011-1270, Item B, and Federal Regulations 40 CFR 62.15250, allowed us to reduce the frequency of mercury emission testing on the two existing municipal waste combustor units 1 and 2 to once every 3 years. This occurred after 3 years of testing showed that the facility met the reduced frequency testing requirements of the permit. The average test results since 2004 for mercury at the facility has been about 2 micrograms per dry standard cubic meter, well below the state requirement of 60 micrograms per dry standard cubic meter for the long-term mercury emissions. This proposed amendment is in line with the current federal mercury testing requirements for the new small Class 2 municipal waste combustors. And the county's concern with this current statute is that the required additional mercury testing would cost our citizens and businesses approximately $40,000 annually without adding any environmental benefit. The new municipal waste combustor unit 3 at the OWF will be fired with the same waste that's fed to the existing two units, and unit 3 has the same pollution control systems that the existing one and units 1 and 2. We maintain that applying the statute on a per unit basis rather than on a per facility basis will not yield any meaningful new information to the state's efforts to reduce mercury emissions or to provide further protection to the environment or our citizens. To my knowledge, the MPCA does not oppose this change being sought by this amendment. The change would currently apply only to the facilities serving Olmsted and Dodge counties and the facilities serving Polk, Douglas, Stearns, and Fairburn counties. Both these facilities are in the process of adding a new unit for expansion of waste processing capacity. The existing solid waste management practices in these counties will remain the same, including the education and outreach to remove mercury from waste stream, the same highly affected waste combustor design, and licensed and waste combustor certified operators. We propose the proposed amendment will require 1 year quarterly testing that will prove that the equipment being added to the new units meets the standards. And I'm confident that the year of quarterly testing for mercury will show similar results as the existing two units. Annual testing for the following 2 years will be adequate to show that the new units meet the performance permit requirements. I respectfully request the committee to adopt the proposed amended statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Helmers, I heard you say that the plants are emitting 2 micrograms, and I forgot, I could not understand or did not hear over what volume of material that is.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's micrograms per dry standard cubic meter of flue gas being emitted.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Helmers, so over the span of a certain amount of time, 6 months or a year, cumulatively, how much mercury is that that'll be going into the atmosphere?
Mr. Olmscheid. This is Helmers. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Helmers.
Mr. Chair, Senator, our most recent reported tests show that for... Double checking here. It's for all units. For unit one, it was 0.3 micrograms per dry standard cubic meter. Oop, that's not the average. I don't have the data in front of me. I'm recalling that it's for both units, it's less than 2 pounds of mercury per year is what is emitted. The last test was actually less than that.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Helmers, you're adding one burner, so after the addition, how much mercury will be going into the atmosphere?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we would ultimately have double the capacity. We do not have that much waste right now. So with Unit 3, with the amount of waste that we have right now, we'll be adding another potentially 2 pounds, 1 to 2 pounds. After Unit 3, it could get up to 3 pounds.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I stepped out of the room, but did you talk about at all what the cost of this testing is or what it runs? I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Mr. Helmers.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we're estimating that it'd add an additional, the three additional quarterly tests that we're asking relief for would be $40,000 per year for all three of those tests. So a total of $40,000 per year additional.
Thank you. All right, next witness.
Mr. Chair, my name is Pete Olmscheid. I'm the Executive Director of Polk Douglas Solid Waste Management in Alexandria, Minnesota. I want to mirror John's presentation. I won't go through the whole thing again, but I just want to elaborate a little bit on the Polk Douglas facility. We also will be adding a third waste combustor to our facility that will, in fact, double the size of our facility. Currently, we emit approximately 2 pounds per year also. For the Unit 3 expansion, we have a TMDL plan so that we will not emit any more than 3 pounds of mercury from Unit Number 3 itself. Currently, our test results from the incinerators on our current two waste combustors are less than 2 pounds. In fact, in 2005, we had 1.2 pounds on Unit 1 and 0.72 pounds on Unit 2 of mercury. So we are very, very low on the emissions from the waste combustors. We feel likewise that this undue burden of extra testing for two more years, the $40,000 per year additional cost, is something that would not gain us any new knowledge, any new information as to we will be burning the same waste in the new waste combustor as we are burning in the two current waste combustors. We'll be adding the same identical technology of waste combustor, the same identical pollution control equipment. So basically, we are just adding an image of what we have currently to our facility.
Do both of your facilities produce electricity?
Mr. Chair, yes, our facility is a combined heat and power plant, so we sell energy both as steam and electricity.
So how many watts does it produce?
We generate right now about 1.5 megawatts that we export. Okay. That's kind of net. After Unit 3, we're projecting that that will go up to between 5 and 6 megawatt.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, at Pope Douglas, we are a cogen facility also. We sell steam to 3M facility, a Douglas County hospital, and to an Alexandria Technical College. And if there's any additional steam left over from what their needs are, we do generate electricity. Currently, we have a 500-kilowatt generator on site. That power is used in-house at our facility. With our expansion, we will be adding another 1 megawatt of power, and at that time, we will probably be pushing electricity out to the utility.
And, Mr. Chair, in Perham, it's steam that is created for the Bongard Creamery and for KLM Enterprises, which is your Tuffy's dog food and your barrel of fun potato chips.
Okay. And Mr. Helmers, do you recall how much waste in tons annually you burn?
Mr. Chair, yes. Right now we're processing about 60,000 tons of waste per year. We have 30,000 tons of waste per year that is processable that's going to the landfill. With the Unit 3 startup, that will be being processed as well. So up to 90,000 tons per year is what we'll have this year.
Well, some you process, most of it you burn.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. By processing, I mean running it through the waste energy facility and converting it to energy.
Okay.
So all of that 90,000 tons per year will be going through the
all
process.
Right. And not into the ground.
Correct.
Mr. Olmscheid, do you recall?
Mr. Chair, we received last year approximately 34,000 tons of that. We burned 28,000 tons of waste. One unique factor of Pope Douglas over the Olmsted facility is that we have a sorting facility on the front end of our system, a MRF, it is called, Materials Recycling Facility, where we actually sort trash, pull recyclables, and harmful objects out of the waste prior to burning what is left over. And with that facility, we can pull more thermostats, more mercury switches, mercury laden items out of the waste stream. Likewise, we have a household hazardous waste facility that's open 5 days a week. We accept fluorescent tubes from our residents free of charge. Last year, we collected 39,000 fluorescent tubes, items that are not in the waste stream anymore but are being dealt with in a proper way.
Mr. Helmers, does your facility do any pre-sorting?
Mr. Chair, no. We do the collection system with the hazardous waste facility. We educate the haulers of what is acceptable waste and what's not acceptable. We do periodic checks of the haulers' waste being brought to the tipping floor to look for materials that aren't supposed to be in there and we require them to comply with those rules.
Okay, Trudy Richter.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
We'll make a seat for you.
I really don't have anything more to add. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association, and these two facilities are members as well as eight others in the state. And we just appreciate your support on this. Thank you.
All right. Does anyone want to testify against the bill? Seeing nobody approaching, Senator Scogin.
We have a. Are we moving to the floor, Mr. Chair? Or?
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I should ask the PCA if they wanted to comment. There was an indication that they did not oppose the bill, but let's just hear from them on the record. Why don't you come up and just state your position?
Mr. Chair, we do need a witness registration sheet up here, too, at some point.
Okay, we'll get that.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Frank Kolesch. I am manager of the Air Assessment and Environmental Data Management Section at the Pollution Control Agency. We are fine with this bill. We've looked at it, and we have no objections or input necessary for this bill.
Thank you. So, seeing no further discussion, Senator Scogin moves that Senate File 2604 be recommended to pass. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Frank.
Senate File 2625, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, committee members. This is a bill that expands the eligibility to disabled veterans for a free annual state park permit. In the past, we'd already given veterans the privilege of getting an annual state park permit, and this bill moves from defining or limiting the veteran population to totally and permanently disabled veterans to any resident veteran with any level of service-connected disability. So we want to make sure that any veteran who would like to travel in and visit the state parks in Minnesota, no matter what the level of disability, gets a free park pass.
You have a witness?
I don't know that there's anyone here today. Mr. Chair, I'll just
any say idea, Senator Erickson Ropes, how many this would impact?
I don't.
Fiscal note doesn't show any additional costs.
Fiscal note, but doesn't estimate how many people go to Texas.
There's a fiscal note, but it's not estimating any measurable impact.
I don't think we need it in finance.
Okay. And Senator Anderson is indicating she does not need to see it in finance as a result. Discussion? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman will move that Senate File 2625 be recommended to pass. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Senator Dahl here. Yeah, why don't we take Senator Dibble if Senator Dahl is not in the room? Senate File 2991, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2991. Mr. Chair and members, what this bill seeks to accomplish is to place in the state's kind of overarching waste management policy statement we have, as members may be aware, kind of a hierarchy of order of priority and how we would choose to treat our waste and our waste stream. And so it places within that hierarchy the notion of source-separated compostable materials within the composting of yard waste hierarchy. So that's at the bottom of page 1, line 1.22 to 1.23. The hierarchy, Mr. Chair and members, of course, is reducing our waste, reusing what we can, recycling then, of course, what we can, then composting, and what it previously only acknowledged was yard waste and food waste. But as composting technology, if you will, what composting practices have become more advanced and more commercially available, we know now that we can compost other items that we throw away and turn that into material that we can use to amend and fertilize the earth with. And that has the benefit, of course, of not only diverting a lot of that which goes into landfills, but also has the benefit of helping us use alternative forms of fertilizer and the like, which has a tremendous benefit, Mr. Chair and members, in our ability to reduce a lot of the greenhouse gases that come from landfills where methane is not captured. Helps us use less fertilizer, which, of course, uses a lot of petroleum and has some other environmental consequences. Mr. Chair, members, I have some folks here who can talk about larger-scale operations, what's going on currently with source-separated compostable materials. I think we'll start.
Mr. Chair.
Senators. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Tim Brownell. I'm co-president and chief operating officer of Eureka Recycling. Eureka Recycling is a nonprofit organization based here in the Twin Cities, which provides services to over 500,000 residents here in the metropolitan area. Those are recycling services, reuse services, composting services, both residentially and commercially. We answer about 60,000 phone calls a year from residents who are asking us questions around reuse and recycling and waste reduction. Our organization's mission is to demonstrate that waste is preventable, not inevitable, and we're trying to do that through services and education. What this bill in front of you today reflects is Minnesota's solid waste hierarchy. And what it's truly trying to do is establish a clear policy that prioritizes composting food waste and non-recyclable papers like paper towels, napkins, pizza boxes, et cetera, which are currently being landfilled and incinerated. This bill will not have any financial impact on the state of Minnesota, but it does create a clear policy which is necessary in order to then follow and establish rulemaking from that.
Mr. Brownell, we have this pizza box discussion almost every week at my house. What is the truth that we need to know, do about pizza boxes?
It is 100% compostable.
Okay. So then we should not put it in with our recycling? Because our recycling people say no pizza boxes.
That is correct. Currently, you are not to most programs in the state do not allow for the collection of pizza boxes in their recycling programs.
All right. So then what are we doing? Just help me through the process of this one item.
Sure.
What would need to be done?
Yeah, the issue with pizza boxes is in most cases, the pizza boxes themselves are contaminated with food waste, whether it's oils, grease, cheese, other food products, which render it non-recyclable. So the options for it would be to be able to compost it, but we currently don't have a policy that prioritizes it in that manner.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on pizza boxes, wouldn't you treat differently the ones that you buy frozen pizzas in that are where the actual food does not make contact with the outer case as in many others?
Mr. Brownell?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is the same issue. Well, it's a different issue. Many times that material is actually so that it can sit in your freezer, it's treated with plastics and plasticizers, which also makes it very difficult to recycle it. You cannot recycle that traditionally with regular cardboard.
Really?
It is, again, though, that material would be compostable.
So we should We need to pass this policy, otherwise we need to put our pizza boxes in our compost bin, which doesn't seem very practical unless we cut it up into fine pieces.
Yeah.
Well,
please introduce yourself.
Yes, Senator. I'm Susan Hubbard, and I'm also with Eureka Recycling. And what this bill does right now is it clarifies the policy currently right now, and the policy very clearly states that composting yard waste and food waste is elevated in the hierarchy, but the composting of non-recyclable papers like paper towels and napkins and things that are easily compostable is not elevated. And so right now, none of those materials are really getting composted, very little. In the state of Minnesota, we're actually composting less than 3% of our stream, while 25% of what's in the garbage is compostable. The policy is very unclear, and what this legislation does is clarifies that policy so that rules can follow that establish the ability for communities to start composting these materials. And with the pizza box, of course, there, Linden Hills right now is a great example of how that's happening, and they're going to talk to you about how you would get your pizza box in the right size to fit in your container and put it at the curb to get it composted. But composting at your curb is not widely available, and the reason that it isn't widely available is because right now policy is very uncertain and very unclear about what can be collected and what can't, and this legislation helps to clarify that, and it makes way for these programs to start.
All right. Okay, very good. Did you have anything to add, Ms. Hubbard, in your testimony? We have you down as a witness.
I just wanted to clarify that 25% of what we're now incinerating and burying in landfills is compostable. In this material, a lot of it is food waste, which 70% of that is water, and incinerating water is not an energy producer. And in landfills, this creates methane, and landfills are the single largest the source of methane that humans produce. And so what this bill does is it sets a policy that says that we shouldn't be putting it in landfills and incinerators where it's actually inhibiting the progress of our integrated waste management structure. We should move it up where it can be composted. Thank you, Chair.
So in a sense, we could be becoming more energy efficient by burning less water-based items.
That's true.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is kind of similar to your question about what should I do at home, but broader question, I guess, is should you be composting things, food waste that has, say you have paper napkins or paper towels, you mentioned that, if they're processed and they're bleached and they, you know, they're white because they've been bleached, things like that, does it make, I mean, what's the best thing to do with those? Because if you put those in your compost, you have some kinds of remnants of those chemicals.
Ms. Hubbard.
Chair, Senator Anderson, it is an imperfect world right now, and the composting of that is imperfect, while the incineration and the landfilling of that is more imperfect. And those materials that are bleached are extremely dangerous in incinerators, where incinerating chlorine-based products creates dioxins. In landfills, there's similar difficulties in which it's released either through gas or through liquid. So the composting of those materials is better than the disposal of them. And yet what we're seeing more and more is the unbleached napkins and the unbleached paper towels and the high levels of post-consumer content in those materials. And those are the items that we should be looking for and shopping for. But while we say that, those aren't always readily available, and they're not always the cheaper items. So I think it's better to compost now than to landfill or incinerate them, but there's still a lot of room in terms of progress in how products are made.
Felicity Britton.
Welcome. Hi, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for having us. I am the executive director of Linden Hills Power and Light, and we've been fortunate enough to be conducting a source-separated organics program since September 2008. And I just kind of wanted to give you the perspective of the community out there. We have 1,200 residents in our neighborhood composting. There are about 90 schools composting and a ton of cities, Hutchinson, Orono, Wayzata, Minnetonka, Loretto, Maple Plain. There's 8 cities in Swift County. There's a bunch of people out there composting, and this is a higher use. If they can put in their pizza boxes, their paper towels, tissues, Q-tips, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you can include and use as a resource. So at the schools, they're putting in their milk cartons, their napkins, their waxed paper. So about 90% or more of the school waste can be composted. The Twin Stadium is going to be recycling organics. So if you get your hot dog and a piece of waxed paper and a little paper boat, all of that can be composted. So you're suddenly moving from a recycling rate of like 40% for bottles and cans. You're adding in another 25% of not only the food waste, but all those food-soiled paper products, which, as Susan mentioned, you want to get out of an incinerator. It's like putting wet noodles on a campfire. So you don't want to waste all that energy to burn the wet stuff. You don't want it in a landfill releasing methane. So what we want to do is make a beautiful, valuable resource which, you know, replenishes our topsoils, reduces soil erosion, prevents polluted storm water runoff, and captures carbon dioxide. So really, I don't see any downside to adding these products in and just broadening that description of compostables from foods, just food scraps, to just be a little broader.
Thank you. Was Tom Brown going to? Tom Brown?
Want to add anything?
I am here, Mr. Chair. My main purpose today was to introduce Felicity, which she did an excellent job doing herself. And the other thing I was thinking about is,
if you would like to testify, we do need you to have a seat and introduce yourself formally. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Tom Braun, Mr. Chair, members. Linden Hills Power and Light began in my living room 3 years ago. A small group of neighbors got together. And the reason I'm telling you that is that there's been an amazing response to the kinds of things that we've been able to begin in our neighborhood. Felicity didn't get a chance to tell you that over half of the households in our neighborhood are participating in the pilot project that she just mentioned. So I think that's my main contribution today, is just convey to you the grassroots energy and enthusiasm that we have uncovered with just a kind of small informal meeting 3 years ago.
Okay. One question, Senator Dibble. You've included source-separated compostable materials, and I understand why. And you've deleted food waste but retained yard waste. Why delete food waste and not yard waste? And just, say all source-separated compostable materials.
I'll defer to the experts, Mr. Chair, but I think the answer is because source-separated compostable materials refers to materials that are generated inside the house, inclusive of paper and food.
Correct. All right. Okay. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one more general question in terms of making composting more available to average people? Are there still a lot of city ordinances that prohibit backyard composting? And why are we not collecting compost with our recyclable materials? Because if you can't do that, a lot of people just aren't going to be able to do it in their backyards.
Mr. Brownell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, yes, in many communities, particularly the backyard composting of food waste is prohibited. So there are restrictions. Some communities allow it, some do not. There's a good bit of uneven rules and ordinances around that on a local level. And the reason why it's not broadly being done on collection is partly the imbalance and uncertainty in terms of what the hierarchy is allowing for, and particularly the issues of investment, that people are not investing in and markets for composting facilities, industrial composting facilities, because of uncertainties about will waste be directed or compostable materials be directed towards those facilities. As you move the materials up the hierarchy, it actually incentivizes investment. It makes them sure for folks. It creates more jobs. There are four jobs for every one job that you would see in a landfill or an incinerator when you compost the material. So people are ready to invest in these facilities. They're ready to develop collection programs. There's just uncertainty with the current structure of the hierarchy.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Anderson?
Is this bill going to fix that?
Mr. Chair, Dibble, not directly, but it certainly will get us on the path, because this will send the signal, to the PCA and the counties and the others who help administer our grant programs and the like, that in our general overarching policies that this is the overarching policy of the state. So it'll start. It'll send a signal to the market. There'll be more eurekas, perhaps proposing being. There'll be requests for proposals that municipalities put out, and companies like Eureka and others will be responsive and cite the hierarchy and say, these are the kinds of things we can do for your citizens at this cost, et cetera. So it'll start to get us down that path. We don't have specific, we don't have specific programs that we're setting up with funding sources and the like. I don't think we necessarily have an appetite or the resources for that as a state right now, but it certainly gets us on that path. It recognizes for the first time this idea of source-separated compostable materials beyond just food waste, which is an important advance.
Would the PCA like to comment? Not seeing anyone approaching. Senator Kielash?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'm not sure who can answer this question. A couple of things. This kind of waste, it needs a different kind of composting than yard waste, or is it the same thing? Could you answer that? And the other thing is how about capacity for handling this? And probably the third thing is this not going to attract rodents for the sake of discussion to waste food?
All excellent questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Typically, depending on the material, backyard, this is not suitable for most backyard composting. In terms of capacity, again, there needs to be a market response. There are some tremendous facilities with tremendous capacity, and we should go on a tour, go see them, because they're pretty amazing. The rodent thing, I think if you're sticking old nasty pizza boxes in your backyard, perhaps you'll have a problem with rats, but that's not what we're seeing done. These are well-managed, professionally run facilities. Did you want to round out my cover?
Yeah, I think in terms of some of the barriers that are in place right now that you're talking about really have to do with rulemaking and very specific rulemaking, which this sets a policy that we're hoping the rulemaking will follow. That right now there's a bunch of possible rulemaking and a bunch of discussion because the policy is really unclear. So going back to your question too, Senator Anderson, is that the inhibitors are, like, for right now, just even collecting this material together in different ways, there's rulemaking that's very confusing or curious that you can interpret to say you can't collect these materials together, that you have to have special permits, and that creates barriers. The same thing is true with processing. And how do we process materials? When we collect just yard waste, are there different regulations for composting it than if we add other materials? There should be. But what are they? They don't exist. So there's no policy that points the way for rules to follow. And so without that, we have a bunch of pilot permits and things floating around, but no clear policy direction.
I do want to emphasize, Mr. Chair, we're not specifically calling for rulemaking. I'm not looking for a trip to state and local government operations. So.
Would anybody like to testify in opposition to Senate File 2991?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. See anyone approaching? Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to the question you raised a little while ago. And I understand why we're deleting food waste, because it's included in source-separated compostable materials. But this is a hierarchy we're expecting citizens to look at and follow. I'm wondering if we should leave food waste in that somewhere, just to make sure that folks who aren't used to reading state laws know what we mean. And I was going to, Senator Dibble, I was going to suggest after materials, and I'm including after materials insert, including but not limited to food waste and yard waste. I'm just kind of looking for your reaction to that, if you think that detracts or improves.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that does the bill any harm and might be a good clarification. I think source-separated compostable materials is probably a term that's known inside the trade and industry, but is not well known in normal parlance. So I think that is a good clarification.
Mr. Knopf has a suggestion to improve that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, since you already have the existing law with food waste, what I would recommend is delete the and on 1.22, the second, or I guess it's the first and now, and insert comma including but not limited to comma, and then reinstate the stricken and at the end of the line, and then reinstate the stricken food waste on 1.23. So it'll read composting of source-separated compostable materials, including but not limited to yard waste and food waste. So you'd basically leave that part of the existing law in place.
Everybody understand
Chairman,
that?
I would move that amendment.
Everybody understand the Fredrickson motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2991. Seeing none, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 2991 as amended be recommended to pass. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl, Senate File 2841.
I don't know, but I...
Senator Dahl.
That makes sense.
Yes. Chair and members of the committee, I have Senate File 2841. Is a bill that the Department of Commerce Petro Fund Division just has some changes and some upgrades and some technical refinement, if you would, on that language related to the Petro Fund and some cleanup. So I'm going to turn it over to Joel Fisher, who is a director with that department.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name again, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher. I'm the director of the Petro Fund program at the Department of Commerce. And there are just four provisions in this bill. Basically, it's cleaning up the statute a little bit. The first provision in lines 1.6 to 1.8 is just a correction of a citation that we discovered. Lines 1.9 to 1.21 is it's a change in the definition of a tank. As you're probably aware, the Petro Fund covers costs to we reimburse costs to cover cleanup of petroleum contamination from underground and above ground storage tanks. In 2003, there was a change to the definition of a tank. Prior to that, it excluded mobile tanks from reimbursement, any release from a mobile tank. In 2003, the definition was changed so that releases from a cargo tank, so if a tanker is driving down Interstate 94 and it tips over, a portion of those costs would be eligible for reimbursement. Unfortunately, when the definition was changed, it kind of opened up the door, I think, broader than was anticipated, and certain other types of containers and such were allowed in. Over the years, we found that doesn't really meet the intent of the program, and so this tightens up the definition a little bit. It still allows for reimbursement of those tanks and transports, but it doesn't allow for reimbursement of other types of tanks. Mainly the ones that we've identified were fuel tanks from like pickup trucks and boats and that sort of thing. The third provision in lines 2.1 to 2.16, this is going back in 2003, we have Petro Fund, we have cost containment rules that were required after a legislative audit that help us to keep costs reasonable that we reimburse. As part of a change in 2003, there was a provision added to our rules that allowed to increase or decrease those maximum costs, allowing for inflation or deflation. In 2006, that occurred. Due to inflation, we had to raise our maximum cost by 10%. When we went to the revisor's office to have them actually publish those changes, they told us that they couldn't do so without a legislative mandate. The maximum costs, the higher costs, are in effect right now, so we are reimbursing at the higher levels, which the rules allow for. We simply, if you went to the state website, it would show the old maximum cost. This is just a way to make it the record more accurate and to allow applicants for reimbursement to actually see what would really be reimbursed. Finally, in lines 2.17 to 2.19, this adds the, basically it gives the Department of Commerce and the Petrofund the ability to file environmental liens. Prior to 2008, the Pollution Control Agency did cost recovery, which was if there was a cleanup needed to be, let's say a release is called in, but the responsible party is either unwilling or unable to do the cleanup, the Pollution Control Agency would step in, do the cleanup, and then do cost recovery and basically get back the costs. That authority came over to the Department of Commerce in 2008, and so we are just looking for the ability to file environmental liens as part of cost recovery. That would be something that we would do as a last resort if we cannot get the funds through any other means.
That's
so,
section 5.
If you have any other questions, I'm available.
Mr. Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question doesn't relate to the bill, but it has kind of a more general question on have you had any more problems with tanks with the biodiesel or primarily the biodiesel, not the ethanol?
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf. We haven't seen a whole lot of releases related to biodiesel yet. For the most part, it's a different kind of cleanup. Ethanol, we've seen a little bit more. But biodiesel has been fairly rare, I think mainly because of the lower levels of, I guess, the biodiesel mixed into the diesel. If someone from the Pollution Control Agency could probably answer that better than I can in terms of the occurrences in that. But from a reimbursement standpoint, we have not seen very much.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, so if I just understood that last statement, you do ethanol cleanup as part of this? Is that's considered a petroleum product or additive to petroleum? Is that correct?
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do. Basically, the Petrofund can reimburse releases of any type of petroleum product as defined in Minnesota Statute 296A, and in that biodiesel is included and ethanol is included.
Okay. Thank you.
This needs to go to Commerce next. Any further discussion? Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, we don't usually see rules delineated in the law. We don't usually list them. I'm wondering if there's a way to avoid that in this bill.
Senator Fredrickson, I saw that and was inclined to let the State and Local Government Committee review it. They normally take a look at any references to rulemaking. That was my inclination.
Chairman, otherwise we could remove the specific reference to the rules here. It's up to what you
would do. I don't have an opinion either way, Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chair, how would you want to do the language?
Mr. Chairman, I have talked with Mr. Knopf about how it might be done to just refer to rules of the board and amounts made by the rules of the board. If Mr. Knopf would want to.
Mr. Knopf, what would you suggest?
Mr. Chairman, what I would suggest is on line 2.13, delete everything after 2. And insert rules of the board. So these would be adjusted dollar amounts determined pursuant to rules of the board. And then on line 2.14, delete everything after in and insert appropriate rules of the board. And then on line 2.15, delete everything before 2. So it would read, upon written notification from the board of the adjusted dollar amounts determined pursuant to rules of the board, the revised statute must adjust the dollar amounts and appropriate rules of the board to reflect the adjustments announced and published by the board.
Fisher?
Chairman, that works for the Petrofund.
I would move that amendment.
All right, everyone understand that motion? No discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. More discussion? Someone like to move this for Senator Dahl? Senator Kielash got his hand up first by a hair. Well, Senator Dahl, Senator Kielash moves that Senate file 2841 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Discussion. Oh, I'm sorry. I need to ask if anyone wants to testify against the bill. I don't see anyone approaching. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senator Saltzman. Senate File 3003, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I do have an author's amendment, a delete all amendment, that I would like to propose to you that will really put the bill in the shape that it is also in the House and addresses some of the issues that have been brought up since the bill was introduced.
Okay, we will pass that out. This is an author's amendment to get it in the shape that she desires. Senator Sieben, would you move the A2?
Sure.
On the A2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Saltzman.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and also committee members. This bill comes to you in regards to some legislation passed in 2008, I believe, that was the result of other legislation considered by, I believe, the House Committee having to do with the siting of landfills. And between 2007 and 2008, Senator Sieben and I were very involved in some water contamination issues related to landfills that had been leaking. And that really... it caused me to really look at what are we doing in terms of the siting of landfills. Certainly, we were doing a lot of work on cleaning them up, and as we proposed legislation of how to clean them up and find the funds to do that, there was a lot of discussion of why are we putting landfills in these locations. There was a number of proposals put forward of things that we might consider that were very specific criteria to be considered in where landfills were sited. And what we heard repeatedly from people was, why don't we go through a rulemaking process? Instead of the legislature setting the guidelines and setting the rules, why don't we go through a rulemaking process? And so legislation passed in 2008 did that. There was extensive work done by a large group of stakeholders to prepare for that, and a report was issued earlier this year on rules to prohibit disposal of solid waste based on site sensitivity to groundwater contamination. And after those rules and proposed and there was great concern that perhaps there had been some proposals put forward that went beyond the intent of this legislation regarding not only future siting, but the present siting of landfills. And so this bill is really an attempt to work with all the stakeholder groups and find some common ground that really limits the rulemaking specifically to landfills going forward, what kind of landfills, but also to, again, keep with the original intent that we need to have some better rules in terms of where we cite these. So I have with me today some people who have been involved in that. First of all, the Friends of Washington County were formed, and Mr. Hugenin has been very involved with them in monitoring this process, and I do want to thank them because this is a very technical issue. And so having the people at the table who understand these particular issues and also understand where is the responsibility of the state in, you know, making sure that we do this right the first time around. So I think there's been a lot of compromise, but I do appreciate the fact that you are hearing this bill and that we do hear from all the stakeholders, because it's very important, I think, that we do that and find some comfort, you know, prior to this rulemaking process going forward. To be noted, I think, is that if we do nothing this session, the moratorium stays in place. And that, I think, is very troubling in that we cannot cite landfills until the rulemaking process is then complete. So I think that is why we are, you know, trying to address some of the concerns before the process continues. So that, Mr. Chair, I guess Mr. Hugenin perhaps could address the work that's been done.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Hugenin. I am with the Friends of Washington County. I have been part of the stakeholder process that was created in the 2008 legislation. I've probably attended 30 to 35 meetings at the PCA. And as such, I would just like to make one comment about the report that the PCA published here last month. There are a number of issues that the report raises, most, if not all, of which can be and should be and will be addressed in the rulemaking process itself. But I do think it's worth just revisiting why there's a rulemaking process in place in the first place. And the PCA has addressed that in its report on page 4 under the heading, "The Need to Manage Landfill Risks More Closely." And I'm quoting from the report, "Several factors contribute to supplementing the traditional engineering-centered approach. These factors include thousands of new chemicals entering the stream of commerce, many of which have not been tested for their health effects when disposed." And I would add, as I've learned during this process, leachate from landfills is tested for dozens, perhaps, of chemicals and compounds, but there are dozens, if not hundreds, of chemicals and compounds that may be contained in leachate that it's not tested for, that we don't know if they're there. If they're there, we don't know in what concentration. So that is a risk that is, to some degree, not been well understood. Quoting from the report again, "The difficulty of predicting long-term effectiveness of engineering controls." We have now 20 to 25 years of experience with post-Title D RCRA technology. The industry is fond of saying that there's not been a major problem that's been identified in that period of time. From my perspective, 20 to 25 years of experience, however, does not provide us with an assurance that that technology will perform as it needs to do for decades or even hundreds of years that waste will remain in the ground. And finally, the difficulty of independently verifying whether best practices in quality control are actually being met. In light of these factors, it is wise to build on sites known to be inherently safer in case engineering and operational safeguards were to fail. So that's the rationale for having a rulemaking process and identifying sites that are more safe, understanding what kinds of sites are less safe for landfill siting going forward, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. You have another witness?
You know, unless there's questions, I think that Mr. Tipping is here. He's not here today, excuse me. I do not, Mr. Chair.
All right, so Bob Tipping is not here. And Mike Robertson? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Robertson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. But today I'm speaking on behalf of the Local Government Business Landfill Siting Coalition. And I want to explain who that group is, because it's been a very active group over the past several months. This is a coalition of businesses and counties and some cities. We have more than 40 counties as part of our coalition. 30 private facilities are represented in the coalition, and as I said, a number of cities. I and Annalee Garlands from the Association of Minnesota Counties have kind of served as the co-chairs of this group. We've had, since December, we've had meetings in Becker, Minnesota, where 100 people have attended from these 40 counties and businesses from around the state. So this is a very important issue for the members of our group. It's something that we have worked together on very hard since this law passed in 2008, working with the Pollution Control Agency, with all the parties involved in the discussion of how we should change our rules with regard to landfill siting. During the process, and PCA has had a very elaborate participatory process for stakeholders, and the folks in our group have coalesced around a philosophy on how landfills should be sited and regulated, which relies on what we call the three-legged stool, which is, number one, what is the hydrogeology? What are the site-specific characteristics of a location where a landfill may be put? And how do they relate to the design and engineering for the facility that's being proposed? And what are the types of waste that are going to be deposited in that facility? We understand the concern of the legislature that was inherent in the law that you passed in 2008, that we want to place a higher and greater attention to the issue of hydrogeology, groundwater sensitivity. So this coalition strongly supports that concept, and it's unfortunate then when we saw the rule that the PCA proposed back in December that it didn't follow this concept or this three-legged stool philosophy. And I would note that I would have you look at the first page of the Delete Everything Amendment, line 33. The sentence that we are concerned about is the one that's in existing law that you passed 2 years ago, which states, the rules for the disposal of solid waste shall include site-specific criteria to prohibit solid waste disposal based on the area's sensitivity to groundwater contamination, including site-specific testing. Now, the PCA told us when they put out their proposed rule in December that they feel that they are legally bound by that language to prohibit, to propose a rule that has exclusionary criteria. In other words, if certain characteristics of the site exist, then there's no further consideration that could occur of that site as a potential landfill site. We also, during our discussion of the issues involved with the proposed rule, were concerned about its effect and impact on existing facilities, and we were concerned with specific proposals that were being made with regard to financial responsibility. We appreciate the fact that Senator Saltzman's Delete Everything Amendment does address the issue of existing facilities and allows the process to move forward and spend more time talking about the issue of financial assurance. So we appreciate that. But this issue of the prohibiting language is a huge issue for the coalition, and we think it should be amended. We are aware of no other state that has such prohibitory language in state law, and we think that that it needs to be changed. We think that it's sending a message that if these site characteristics do not exist with regard to a landfill, then what would that say about siting of a service station, of a wastewater treatment facility, of an ethanol plant, of a septic system, of a pipeline? If they have those same characteristics underlying them, aren't they in some way not adequate to protect the environment? We all know that engineering and technology is part of our system in protecting the environment and in all of its aspects. And so we would be concerned that applying that That position to this, that prohibiting factor here would also raise the question of how it should be applied to those other kinds of facilities. We're also concerned in that same regard that if, even though the language under the Delete Everything Amendment does exclude the new criteria to exist applying to existing facilities, what kind of position are existing facilities going to be in when someone who may not like that facility have it being nearby now says, well, how can you expand this facility or make a change in the boundary of this facility in light of the fact that, that this criteria would be, this facility would be prohibited under this criteria if it were a new facility? So we're concerned about, you know, policy slippage there and how it would affect existing facilities. We think that you can address, that this issue can be addressed in rule. We think that there can be criteria that can be established, that these factors like karst and sensitivity of groundwater and how fast the groundwater flows can be dealt with, and those criteria can be used as prescriptive triggers that would require a more intensive analysis of the site and all the characteristics and factors going into the design and of the facility. And in that process, a very thorough review would be done by the engineers and the scientists and the hydrogeologists, and a conclusion could still be made by the agency that the site should not be permitted. We're not saying that every facility that's proposed should receive a permit, but with the language that's in the law now and the way the PCA is interpreting it, it requires, in their mind, a decision that would exclude siting for just one criteria. We would finally note, Mr. Chair, that this is a really important economic issue as well as an environmental issue. Counties, especially in rural areas, are in great need for facilities to manage their waste, and travel distance for a business or for folks out in the countryside is very important. If these options do not exist, then there will be greater costs, but there will also be greater environmental impact because there will be longer travel distances, there will be more transportation fuels used to get there, there will be more greenhouse gases emitted, and higher costs for citizens and for businesses as well. So we would hope that you could consider amending the language to remove the prohibitory words here. And we would just remind you that the pollution problems from the facilities in Washington County and the known instances of significant pollution that have been identified by the PCA are from facilities that predate the current rule and the current process for permitting landfills, which is very intense and requires very significant engineering design and ability to monitor so that any problem can be detected early and identified and remediated. So I thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment to that addresses this concern, and then maybe as that amendment gets handed out so members can look at it. The Mr. Robertson, in your estimation, what is the real meaning of prohibited language versus a suitability?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, I think prohibit means prohibit. And so it's a red line that, and the PCA has told us that that's the way they interpret the word prohibit. Determining suitability means that it's not a red line and there is then room for discussion about the suitability of the site and its characteristics. And we think what the rule can do that the PCA would adopt would lay out the kind of criteria and characteristics and numbers that need to be addressed as a site is investigated and determined whether it's adequate.
Mr. Robertson, so you're not saying that every facility should be permitted?
Mr. Chair, no.
Does Senator Saltzman's bill or the current law say that every facility should be denied?
Mr. Chair, it does not, but it says it would say that facilities in certain locations could not even be considered because of that one characteristic.
What's wrong with, in a permitting process, what's wrong with proving that facility will not do any harm, given that area's, you know, environmental characteristics?
Mr. Chair, that could happen, as I said. The PCA could deny a permit based upon that the site characteristics were too environmentally sensitive and that technology and engineering will not adequately protect the site. With the prohibiting language, it means you never even get to that conversation, that an arbitrary decision is made up front that if these conditions exist, then we won't even talk about facility. And all we're saying is there should be, if someone is willing to spend the time and effort, then they must believe that they can defend that facility. If they can't, then the facility should not be permitted.
But I think we just agreed that Senator Saltzman is not doing that. What it's saying is that it's just acknowledging that there are times when you absolutely cannot have a facility there because of the makeup of the underground sensitivity. And she leaves it up to the PCA to determine when that's the case. What's wrong with that?
Mr. Chairman, we think the criteria that the PCA has proposed, at least in this first proposal in its draft rule, is arbitrary, that there needs to be further steps taken, and this three-legged stool of what is the actual facility that is being proposed to be sited, that is missing from the language in the existing law and in the bill as before you. It's prohibiting without allowing consideration of the other factors involved.
Mr. Chair.
But it doesn't say the permit shall be, or the landfill shall be prohibited. It just says determine criteria for prohibiting based on the site's groundwater sensitivity to contamination. So, and it leaves it up to the department to figure out what is too sensitive to put a landfill and what can be mitigated. What's wrong with that? Isn't that just kind of a value that we're saying here, that we want to be able, a facility just to be able to prove that it won't be harmful?
I agree with your statement, Mr. Chair. That's what we want to happen. But with the language in that sentence, the PCA has interpreted to mean that we won't even talk about putting facilities in certain areas.
That's
the issue.
That's helpful. Can you give me an example? Give me an example of a facility that's been denied, and under what circumstances?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I can't give you all the history of landfill sightings and what has been denied or not. I don't have that history.
But you're saying that the PCA has been denying permits?
No, Mr. Chair, I said that the PCA can deny a permit for a facility if it believes that the facility cannot be monitored, cannot be remediated, that the groundwater is too or the hydrogeology is too unstable. Those are the criteria that are laid out in the bill. Those are the criteria that should be considered, and that's the analysis that the PCA should make and then determine whether, make a decision on whether that site should be permitted.
The way I'm reading Senator Saltzman's bill, that's exactly what it's saying, but apparently we disagree. That's okay. Senator Frederickson, excuse me, Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I just are we on the stump
amendment,
or did you offer that?
I did.
It was passed out. I presume that it's Senator Stump would like to move
it. Mr. Chair, I think we should concentrate on this amendment instead of going back into the bill.
Well,
maybe that's just me.
Senator Vickerman, that's precisely the issue with the amendment. Senator Stump?
Mr. Chair, a couple small additions to that amendment that was pointed out by Senate counsel. On the last line on 1.8, if we would add 4 after suitability, and then FOR, yes. And then on the page 2, line 2.18, if we would, the third word in is from, and delete from and insert 4. And it just reads better that way.
There's a couple of grammatical additions that you would like to incorporate into your amendment.
Right.
So you want
Mr.
Move
Chair,
the A4?
Just yes, I'd move the A4 or the A2.
A4.
No, is it A4?
A4.
A4.
With these changes,
Mr. Chairman, I was trying to think of an example. One of the situations that I think Mr. Robertson brought up was where you have an existing landfill and then you want to have an expansion. And if the department's interpretation is strictly on the area sensitivity to groundwater, I could see in a situation up in Kitson County where we have an existing landfill a good share of Kitson County, at least close to the valley, is flood prone. So you have, groundwater some groundwater sensitivity. And yet we do, most of the area up there has, I think all of the area up there has actual a water system. It's a rural water system that they do not have wells up there. And so I guess the concern that I have is that the interpretation of the area sensitivity to groundwater contamination may rule out an expansion of that existing facility, which has been a very good facility that serves multiple counties in northwestern Minnesota.
Mary Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the reason for the law that was passed, as I understand it, was that there are just some areas where it's not a good idea to site a landfill. And so what your amendment would do would take away that concept and say that any place you want, you should be able to consider siting one, even if it's karst, for example. And karst means, there's holes all over the ground that go directly down into the aquifer. And I just don't know why we'd want to do that. Senator Stump, and it specifically changes that sentence on 2.3 about karst and would allow a landfill to be sited in a place where the geology is karst. Senator Stump, if you are concerned about expansion of an existing landfill, I think Senator Saltzman's amendment deals with that for most cases, and perhaps that could be accommodated without opening up the whole rest of the state, which is what your amendment would do. I mean, it's one thing to say we want to be able to expand an existing landfill. It's another thing to say that we're going to be able to site them anywhere without saying some sites just are not the right place to even start the process of discussion. And so if all you're concerned about is expansion, maybe we should narrow your amendment to deal with that issue.
Stone?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I do see the value of trying to move it from a prohibition, which the department has interpreted as a non-starter, to a suitability where a landfill should go, and I think the
And I would totally agree that there are places where we don't want landfills, and we don't, you know, we want to protect those areas. But I think the prohibition is the use of a negative to try to get at a solution to the to an issue, and I think Mr. Robertson addresses that. It would be nice to hear from the department, you know, on what they're trying to do. You know, we don't actually spell out very often in statute exactly all the details of, you know, how things operate. Quite often we rely on agencies to make the rules, and sometimes we end up getting into trouble or more trouble if we spell things out, such as the 25-mile grass rule, or seed grass rule, which could be traced back to the same author as this one. But.
Senator Salzman.
On these points, Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Hukunen could perhaps respond. And I think that, you know, Senator Anderson and Senator Stump are both right in that we are feeling that the rulemaking process was the right way to go here instead of the legislature starting to be very prescriptive. So I think that we've had some good discussion, but I would like to have him respond to some of the questions that have been brought up.
Mr. Hukunen.
Mr. Chairman, members, indeed this legislation and the rulemaking process that is underway represents a paradigm shift. The three-legged stool is a methodology for designing a landfill, and it's a perfectly fine methodology for that. You take into account the toxicity of the waste, take into account the sensitivity of the site, and the three-legged stool then tells you what sort of engineering controls you would like to install in order to be protective of that site, of human health and the environment. What the three-legged stool, however, does not contemplate is the failure of those engineering solutions. If the engineering solutions should fail, and you have placed that in a site that is highly sensitive, you could have contaminants in the groundwater in a very short period of time. What the new paradigm contemplates is that first you pick a site where you have natural conditions, natural hydrogeology, which is protective of groundwater. You have clay soils, silt soils, low permeability soils, which will help to contain those contaminants, prevent them from getting into the groundwater, or at least delay them for a period of time such that you can respond to that. Once you have selected a site of that nature, then of course you engineer your containment, you engineer your monitoring and detection, so that then I would suggest then you really have a three-legged stool. You have natural containment, you have engineered containment, you have monitoring and detection. The three-legged stool method really does not rely on natural containment at all, and in fact, I would submit that that's a two-legged stool. You have engineered containment, you have engineered monitoring and detection, but if you have an engineering failure, there's no natural qualities in that site necessarily to help to mitigate that the effects of that failure. I would also suggest that the legislation does not prohibit, and Mr. Chairman, to your point, does not prohibit the siting of a landfill in any site unless, in fact, it fails to meet the standards that will be defined in the rulemaking process and will be defined in the rule. So I don't see the language as being prohibitionary of any particular site by itself.
Senator Kielash and then Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Haugen, based on that last description, I would say that you'd wipe out landfills in most of northeastern Minnesota where there's very little clay, there's nothing but groundwater, and I believe, depending on how you determine what groundwater contamination is, most of the state's got an aquifer somewhere underneath it. So you've got a pretty well-covered prohibition on just about any landfill in the state, which doesn't solve the problem with the solid waste. So, you know, can you help me with how we solve the problem with the solid waste based on these rules?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, there's a couple comments. First of all, I don't think anyone has supported the idea of trucking waste around the state of Minnesota. That's not a solution, and I think everyone agrees to that. I don't necessarily accept, however, that the only choices are to truck waste over unreasonable distances or to bury them in marginal sites. Now, the rulemaking process is going to have to find that middle ground between those two extremes. And let me answer another part of your question. Though I myself am not a hydrogeologist, it's my understanding, though, from conversations with the PCA, and I think there has been some information published somewhere along the way, that the PCA has conducted an analysis and does believe that under this legislation, and of course the rules themselves are not yet made, but this legislation is not going to prohibit on a blanket basis the siting of a landfill in any county in Minnesota. There are micro sites, even in areas that are generally not hospitable to landfills, you can find sites that would be suitable. The PCA probably can give you a better answer than that, but that's my understanding from my time in the stakeholder process.
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chairman, just on that point, I don't think the PCA has done a thorough analysis of whether that statement is true or not. Clearly, there would have to be site-specific analysis of any site to determine what the flow of the groundwater is and what the nature of the geology is. This change in the law would not just say you can site a landfill anywhere. What the change would leave in the law is the language that was in the law and language that is being added by this amendment, by Senator Saltzman's Delete Everything Amendment, which raises red flags and says sensitivity to groundwater is a very big issue, an important issue, and the karst geology is a very important issue. We want the agency to deal with that more specifically in the rule. And it tells everyone who wants to sign a landfill that if you're considering siting in an area where you've got karst, and in fact the PCA rule already has some very specific language about not siting in real karst geology. The bill as it's written says where karst is likely to develop, and we're not sure exactly what that means. So I think the amendment follows the intent that you had 2 years ago to place a higher standard with regard to sensitivity to groundwater and geology, and I think that it will work if you amend as we've suggested, and if you don't, it would lead to situations where travel time and distances and long hauls would occur at some point in the future.
Mr. Robertson, what if on 1.35, instead of the A4 amendment, after contamination, it said, despite mitigation, or regardless of mitigation. Maybe it's not your entire concern, but I'm gathering that you don't want the presumption on in favor of the environment to exclude common mitigation efforts, mitigation practices. That was a fear that I sensed in some of your comments. So wouldn't it balance it out if it's, instead of the amendment, it said groundwater, based on the area's sensitivity to groundwater contamination, regardless of mitigation efforts. So they would then have to figure out, if that was to say that, then they would have to figure out criteria on that, on potential contamination, if nothing, if you tried everything, it would still be contaminated. Doesn't that change the bar a little bit, kind of find some middle ground of the presumption for prohibition, but, the presumption for mitigation as well?
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm misunderstanding your proposal, but I think what you proposed is exactly what is in the existing sentence, that there shall be site-specific criteria to prohibit. And what you're saying is prohibit regardless of the mitigation, which is the same. To me, it seems like you're saying the same thing that the sentence says now.
Maybe it didn't come out the way I intended, or I'm not conveying it well enough. What I'm trying to say is my suggestion is to examine the criteria based on the area sensitivity, but factoring in mitigation efforts.
Mr. Chair, I think that is the intent of the amendment, and that is what would happen under the amendment.
We're talking about a presumption here. Basically, it boils down to where should the presumption be? Should the presumption be that one should prove that it won't be harmful? Should the facility prove that it will not be harmful? Or should the people concerned prove that it will be? I think that's what it kind of boils down to.
I believe that the facility proposer always bears the responsibility to prove that the facility will not harm public health or the environment. That is the responsibility of the proposer. And with the addition of this reference to site sensitivity, the groundwater sensitivity, and karst, you have now raised their level of responsibility to show that if you are in those circumstances yet to be defined in the PCA rule, then your burden is going to be tougher than if you were not in that situation. So the message that's being sent to a landfill proposer is that if you can avoid those conditions that we've raised the red flag on, then you should go where that, because you probably will have an easier time getting your site permitted, and it will cost you less if you go to that other site. So I think you are having the intended effect of telling folks you better try to find what is a better site, because you're going to have to bear a higher level of responsibility to show that a site that has these conditions is protective.
So you're not necessarily against recognizing that area's sensitivity to groundwater contamination. You just feel that deleting the word prohibit takes a sharp edge off of the considerations.
I think, Mr. Chair, that clearly as the bill would be amended, it does have that effect of protecting.
Let's if anyone has any burning comments, we can recognize you. But Senator Saltzman, last words on the A4?
Well, I will defer to Mr. Hugonen because I think he understands what this does and would be able to more fully explain what the intent is of this language.
Well, I think we heard. Comments, Mr. Hugonen?
Well, I would certainly agree that the burden of proof needs to be with the proposer to prove that a site is safe rather than the burden of proof shifting to the public to prove that it's not. And I would ask the committee to consider the significance of the language in that light.
All right. Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, we haven't discussed the assurance part of the bill at all.
No, this is just on the A4 amendment.
Oh, the A4. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to divide the amendment. I'd like to divide lines 6 and 7 to be voted on separately. And that section is a section that amends the sentence on page 2. Dealing with karst.
Okay. All right, so between lines 5 and 6, you mean?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes, and then between
7 and 8.
1.8 would be separate also.
Okay. So are we going to vote three times?
Just twice.
Okay, so we're Senator Fredrickson has moved to divide the amendment. Which portion would you like to vote on first?
Senator Stumpf.
Senator Stumpf.
If I understand Senator Fredrickson's motion is to divide the amendment between 1.4 and 1.5, or 1.5 and 1.6.
Right, and then between 7 and 8.
And then between 7 and 8. Okay. Well, I think we should vote on the first part of the amendment.
So this is –
Mr. Chairman.
So basically, this amendment is divided, carves out lines 6 and 7, the karst portion on page 2. And so the portion we will vote on now is lines 3, 4, and 5, and 8.
Right.
All right, does everyone understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bears in doubt. All those in favor, please raise your hand.
I'll stick with my friend.
All those opposed. Motion clearly prevails. Amendment, that portion of the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
I don't think we should ever be citing a landfill over a karst area, and I want to be on record of opposing it, so I'd like a roll call vote.
Okay. Roll call has been requested on lines 6 and 7. Get our roll sheet up.
They have holes in the ground.
No water.
Chair will vote yes. Excuse me. Excuse me. The chair will vote no.
Anderson?
No.
Dibble?
No.
Dill?
Yes.
Bobby? Fredrickson?
No.
Ingebrigtsen?
No.
Kielash?
No.
Olson?
No.
Parasol?
No.
Saxhog?
No.
Sharon?
No.
Sieben?
No.
Skogan?
No.
Stump?
Yes.
Vickerman?
Yes.
Two of us in here.
Three yeses. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 no.
The vote is 3 in favor and 12 against. That portion of the amendment of the motion does not prevail. That portion of the amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 3003. Senator Kielash, did you have a question on the?
Yes, I did.
You had to bring up financial assurance again.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I didn't bring it up.
We
it's in the
escape.
Bill.
Couldn't escape.
He's going to offer a Carlson bill as an amendment.
Part of my questions for Mr. Chair is that I don't know the current financial assurance is required, and I'd like to get an update on that, and then also see what this is going to do to future landfills. So that's
okay.
What's currently being done?
Senator Saltzman, Mr. Huguenin, or would the PCA be better to talk about this? PCA like to talk about current financial assurance rules regarding solid waste disposal facilities.
That would be helpful, Mr. Chair, because I think that what we're looking at here is, again, we worked with all the stakeholder groups on this, and when we talk about the three-legged stool is also looking at times when we do find that there are problems and cleanup needed. How can we be assured that the public is not at risk? So, and I know
committee.
That this, and this goes to the Finance Committee, I believe, Mr. Chair, so there will be further discussion on that issue.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig. I'm a division director with the Municipal Division at the Pollution Control Agency. And the question is, I'm sorry.
What are the current rules regarding financial assurance of solid waste disposal facilities, and does this, how much do these provisions change what you're doing now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to step back a little bit from that and give you some context and then try to respond to your question. So when the legislature laid out this requirement to do rules, the legislation says rules are to ensure the public does not have to pay for the cost of groundwater contamination from landfills. So the idea that we brought forward in our report to the legislature is sufficient financial assurance for existing and new landfills so that the taxpayers do not have to pay for the cost of closure and post-closure care. One of the questions that this amendment answers is whether this applies to both existing and new landfills. We interpreted the legislation to be both. This amendment clearly talks about new landfills only. When we looked at the issue of financial assurance, we saw a conflict in the requirement to ensuring that taxpayers do not have to pay the cost and previous legislation that put a 30-year cap on the amount of post-closure care for existing municipal solid waste landfills. So one thing this legislation does, it removes the cap and says that the 30 years is a minimum for solid waste rules, I mean for solid waste landfills. This legislation says the rules that we adopt should only address new landfills, however. So the financial assurance provisions and the landfill siting provisions will be directed only to new landfills, not existing landfills. The current financial assurance rules provide different tools by which landfills can meet their financial assurance requirements. They include self-insurance, surety bonds, trust funds, and letters of credit. In our analysis of the financial tools, we believe that self-credit and surety bonds are not viable financial assurance mechanisms, and our proposed rules would look at cash, trust funds, and letters of credit. There has been a question raised about that. Counties, for example, are not able to get letters of credit, only cash trust funds, and the feeling is public entities should have other tools available to them. So what this legislation proposes is a work group to using the Minnesota Management and Budget, MMB, expertise to look at the tools available over a six-month period, and as well as other stakeholders involved in the landfill issues, and based on that six-month process, then develop rules and appropriate mechanisms based on that process. So that's also what the amendment provides.
My interpretation of what you just said was that there are currently no assurances from current landfills or being held by the state or PCA, and that this just affects the new ones.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, no, that's not correct. Okay. There currently is financial assurance requirements for all of the landfills. There on municipal solid waste landfills, the assurance is capped at 30 years. Mm-hmm. For industrial waste and demolition landfills, there's a minimum of 20 years. So there's no cap on the there's no cap like there is in municipal solid waste.
To follow up, so who's administering that portion of the assurance requirements, the amount of assurance needed, and the quality of the assurances that the landfill owners are providing?
Mr. Chair and Senator, right now it's the Pollution Control Agency through the permits that we issue and the financial assurance rules that we have in place for existing landfills.
Okay. Senator Stump?
Just two quick questions. One, Mr. Chairman, how many municipal landfills do we have in the state?
Ms. Thorvig?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I believe there's 23. 21, I'm sorry.
21. And then, Mr. Chair, actually two little quick questions. On the new landfills, are most of those private or most of those public?
Thorvig.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I'm not sure the last proposed new landfill was the XL Ash Landfill in Washington County, so that was private. So we haven't had a lot of proposals for new mixed municipal solid waste landfills in the state.
Okay. And then the final question is, and I'm sorry Senator Dill left, I was just wondering if gold bullion could be used for financial assurance.
Their stuff sounds like they'll be talking about it. Further discussion on Senate File 3003.
Oh, I can move it.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 3003, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion. Did anyone want to testify against or for this bill? Go ahead. Come on up and introduce yourself.
My name is Dennis Seams. I'm the Olmsted County Landfill Manager. And I would specifically like to look at line 4-4, if I've got the correct or latest one, where it talks about during the operating life of a facility for a minimum of 30 years after closure. The agency just testified that there's a cap on post-closure care up to 30 years, but not longer. I'd like to point out that the current rules, section 7035, 2655, post-closure care and use of property, addresses that. And in fact, in the statement of need and reasonableness behind the rule, it specifically says an allowance has been made for the lengthening or shortening of post-closure care period based on technical documentation that conditions warrant change. This allowance rewards or penalizes the facility owner or operator for activities taken during the life of the facility that decrease or increase the need for action after closure. So I'd like to mention that the current rules allow for the agency to increase or decrease post-closure care periods. And the reason this is important and why I would like to see three words stricken from that line, a minimum of, is that currently there are six or seven facilities in the state that are doing leachate recirculation. And what that is doing, it's breaking down the waste faster than a typical dry tomb landfill would. And we're seeing preliminary numbers on the toxicity of the leachate in these still operating landfills that show that the toxicity levels are going down in them because of this recirculation. So I think by putting a minimum of 30 years, that would take out the opportunity for facilities that decide to put up the engineering and the money to do leachate recirculation. It's not cheap. And by doing so, they're reducing that toxicity of their leachate much more quickly than a typical landfill. That takes away the opportunity for them to reduce some of their post-closure care activities. We all agree we're going to have to mow them. We're going to have to make sure trees don't grow up on them. But there is an opportunity in the current rule to lengthen or shorten based on the site's history.
Thank you, Mr. Seams. Lengthen or shorten what?
The length of the post closure care period, where we're talking about a minimum of 30 years.
Okay.
The agency, or by this three words, a minimum of being in there,
right,
it takes away the opportunity for a real good landfill operator who's going over and above the call of duty to put in this type of system to be able to shorten some of their post closure care duties. Now, the cap doesn't need to be there because under current rule it says the agency can also lengthen that period if they think the site is not ready to discontinue post-closure care.
Mr. Sims, I'm reading that part a little differently. I don't see it as saying that a facility couldn't do that. This portion of the law only refers to the facilities submitting proof of the financial capability
to provide reasonable and necessary response for a minimum of 30 years after closure. So, you know, it sounds like there's some new technology coming forward, and that's excellent. But what this is only saying is that you still need to show that you can do that, that you can provide a response 30 years after closure when you're doing this. It's only refers to the proof of financial capability. What's wrong with that?
I guess put that way, there isn't anything. But what concerns the coalition is that the lengthening portion also, Mr. Chairman, would allow somebody within the agency to all of a sudden say you need to do 60 years rather than 30 or some arbitrary number. I guess it makes it look like a one-way street rather than a two-way street, Mr. Chairman.
If you look at what it's saying, it's almost just clarification because it says, well, no, it says for 30 years after closure. It marks a specific amount of years, and this is saying that should be a minimum. It doesn't, at least for a non-municipal, I think that was the concern. Are yours your coalition is it mainly municipal facilities?
Mr. Chairman, our coalition, as mentioned earlier, is 70 or 80 facilities potentially. There's 21 MSW sites, which some are private and some are public. I think there's 19 industrial sites. Some are public, some are private, and then a whole lot of public and private demolition and industrial facilities too.
If Senator Saltzman and the PCA promise to talk with you about your concerns and explain what they're doing with this particular provision, we promise in return that we would revisit it either in the Finance Committee or on the floor if there was indeed something that you just cannot reach an impasse here, or we just cannot reach an agreement here?
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd be willing to do that. We're just looking for a logical, reasonable answer here.
Okay. Fair enough. Senator Kielash?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I understand Mr. Seams right, the 30-year minimum is a disincentive to invest in the new technology that eliminates the leaching sooner because they're going to have to wait that long anyway. By installing the new equipment that does a better job, the landfill management will be able to stop paying bonds or stop having the assurance. So I think that's what he's referring to. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's a pretty good summary. The idea is that it is already in rule right now where the PCA can lengthen or shorten that post-closure care period. So,
and remember, this is, Mr. Simons, this portion is only with regards to the facility submitting proof of their financial capability. And the law, and in that regard, the rule cannot shorten it. Because if you read it, the law says for 30 years. Now, the proposals is proposing, is saying a minimum of 30 years, but it cannot be shortened to 30 years under current law. Senator Saltzman?
On that point, Mr. Chair, you know, just to offer some comfort, I'm very, like to work with all the stakeholders in this bill. I was not aware of, concerns with this particular issue. And I think, though, at the same time, we need to be aware that, again, as testimony was given, there are chemicals that we were not aware of before that we find in our water now because we couldn't find them. And that was some of the issue in Woodbury and Washington County was that they didn't realize that these chemicals existed. So I think it's there to also protect the state, but I obviously hear what you're saying. We do not want to provide disincentives, but we're not asking them for do anything different. It's just to have the financial assurance there should something happen. But I am very willing to work with the stakeholder groups to find that, you know, sweet spot in this issue.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Perhaps it's to PCA. Is the financial assurance level in the same amount throughout the 30 years, or does it decrease with time, and particularly the type of management and equipment that are installed? In other words, 30 years, the first 5 years might be $5 million of assurance.
Right.
Well, the last 5 years might be
$500,000. Yeah, it might be the same or a longer period of time under this, but if there's a better technology, as you all are seem to be working on, you can decelerate that assurance at different levels up through that time, as we learned so intimately last week. Ms. Thorvig, is she still here? Let's hear from Ms. Thorvig. We should probably get moving on this.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring up Gary Pulford, who manages the regulatory program for landfills. I don't have the specific information, and he has that.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Pulford. I manage the solid waste program at the PCA. The question, Senator, is does it decrease, financial assurance decrease with time? The answer, it varies. It depends on the landfill. It depends on the rate of degradation of the waste in the landfill. It depends on the site of the landfill. So the best answer I can give you, Senator, is that it varies depending on the landfill.
But it can?
It can decrease over time.
Yeah.
Or, Senator, it can increase over time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I just wanted to speak in favor of keeping a minimum of 30 years and just to expand a little bit on why this is important. As Senator Saltzman alluded to with the Washington County landfill, 30 years ago when dumping of perfluorinated chemicals began to take place, it wasn't prohibited, and the county or the public didn't realize that it was going to become such a significant health concern and a remediation cost, for that matter, for the state ultimately, because the state ultimately paid millions of dollars to remediate the Washington County landfill. So I think it's in the public's best interest to keep a minimum of 30 years after, so that as issues develop over time, there is some financial assurance in place to ensure that there's money to clean up the result of the pollution.
All right, so Senator Saltzman will listen to the issues of Mr. Symes, and if the minimum of 30 years portion is language is retained, the rules should have clear consideration of new and proven technologies that could potentially decrease the financial assurance over time. On Senator Anderson's motion, seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Very much, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Members, we have one left on our agenda. It's Senator Chaudhry's 3210. As he comes to the table, I'll remind those who are on the subcommittee on lands that we meet at 6 o'clock tonight. The agency has a pretty robust bill, and there are about a dozen individual bills. So come prepared, and we'll try to work as quickly as we can through those provisions this evening.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebretson.
Pepperoni with extra cheese for tonight.
You can bring all the pepperoni.
Oh, I thought that was
the
chair,
like, Senator.
He wants it in there. Senator Chaudhry. It's pretty cheesy.
It's leader, no, pretty cheesy, yeah.
Okay,
tonight or tomorrow, I know.
It's not
fine.
It's not
fine.
We have before us Senate File 3210, Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, this is a bill proposed by Bowser, Board of Water and Soil Resources, asking us to consider amending some of our statutes regarding appeals of wetland actions and decisions. I believe I have a...
Yeah.
Got it. The A1 amendment to get it in.
This is a delete all. Senator Chaudhry moves the A1. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Chaudhry on Senate File 3210 as amended.
Mr. Jaski.
Mr. Jaski, welcome to the committee. If you would please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, John Jaski, Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and what I thought I would do is just walk through this amendment that Senator Chaudhry's got before you.
Mr. Jaski, I'm going to ask you to pull that microphone up under your chin, please. Thank you.
Sorry, thank you. I'll just walk through this beginning on lines 1.14. Just really, that's just a typographic correction there. We've got a terminology that's defined elsewhere with a hyphen, believe it or not, that makes a difference. On the bottom of page 1, on 1.30 through 1.33, this is a bit of language that would deal with a circumstance unforeseen that affects projects up on the Iron Range, these mining projects. I'm going to have the page, if I could, pass out a map. Just I think it'll help me explain this. I'm sorry, I should have given it to you when you were over here, but the reason for this language is threefold. Number one, as most of you know, many of these mining projects are directly on the Continental Divide that separates the Rainy River watershed from the Lake Superior watershed, and some of these projects, of course, actually have potential wetland impacts in both of those watersheds, even on the same project. The second reason is that wetland impacts that occur under a mining project, under a permit to mine, are actually treated much like a wetland banking project, where they take place over a very long period of time. You identify the mitigation sites up front, and then debits are made from those pre-established sites over time under the DNR's permit to mine authority. So they're handled separately from all the other Wetland Conservation Act type decisions. And thirdly, in northeastern Minnesota, we recently completed an analysis to identify the most viable and ecologically beneficial wetland mitigation opportunities, because in that part of the state we have an abundance of wetlands, and there are therefore not as many opportunities to find good, high-quality wetland mitigation. And so what this language would simply do is that if you see in the map in front of you now, there are two basins that have been delineated by numbers 1 and 2 in this case, those two watersheds I mentioned. And what this would allow is the mitigation opportunities to be pursued in either of Area 1 or Area 2 without any kind of a ratio penalty. We believe that's important because that will allow the mining companies who are located on that Continental Divide to look for good wetland mitigation sites as close as possible to the site, rather than maybe first going to someplace much further away in one of those bank service areas, as they're called. So that's all this language does, is allow some opportunity to look for wetland mitigation nearest to the site that's being impacted under the DNR's permit to mine. I'll keep going then on page 3. These two changes, the deletion on line 3.6 and then the insertion on line 3.15, the intent of both of these together is to provide an ability to process appeals. As you may recall, decisions that are made under the Wetland Conservation Act are appealable under an administrative appeals process, both at the local level and the state, that was put in place to, you know, to keep these things out of district court primarily, where they're, you know, time-consuming and expensive. And so we've used this process for, you know, a decade and a half now, and it's worked well. However, we've got a situation based on the language that was amended in 2007 where we could have an appeal filed the very last day of a time period that's prescribed for an action, and therefore the local government wouldn't have an opportunity to process that appeal. Now, I will let you know, and maybe others will testify, that we've been talking with the builders and the cities about this, and there might be a better way to do this, or an alternative way nonetheless, maybe better sort of in the eyes of the beholder. But with that, I mentioned to Senator Shad, we would probably invoke our state and local government committee, because some of the things we would be looking to do would refer to their authorities. So I'll just leave that one at that and keep going and then come back. Line 3.23, these are, again, just corrections to be clear about which of these different kinds of decisions are appealed. This is not a change of any substance, just correcting the terminology. And then on page 4, on line 4.20 through 4.24, we do provide the, we currently have this in rule, but this helps clarify it in statute, the ability of a person who receives an order through an enforcement action to correct that matter, to have additional due process for an appeal, an administrative appeal, before that matter becomes potentially a criminal citation. And so if they receive one of these orders, a restoration order, a replacement order, they would have 30 days to file an appeal, and then the agency would have up to 60 days to process that appeal, because we've got to make findings. This is a, you know, a new decision that's not got a prior record, so we'd have to establish a record for that decision. So, Mr. Chairman, members, that's the overview of the language.
Well, Mr. Jashke, could you take me through that part, beginning on 4.20, and kind of explain what might be occurring and how it seems like it would potentially make the permitting quite a bit longer.
Mr. Chairman, what this does is, it's not a situation where there's a permit at all. It's actually a violation that's been presumed. And so the landowner will have been given a stop work order, typically, because it's potentially a violation of the law. And then there will be a finding, and then by the local government, they will then prepare an order issued by the conservation officer, in most cases under DNR, or some cases a city or county law enforcement official, to this property owner. And this language would simply allow that property owner to, if they chose to appeal that decision in case there was something that was in error in that order.
Other questions for the witness? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would be the appeal length now? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, this language in a similar form is already in our rule, which the legislature authorized us to create. We're trying to just simply make this language consistent with what's already in rule, so it's not changing anything in terms of practice. It establishes in this language an appeal process if someone receives an order and wishes it to be reviewed.
No, just state and local. Follow-up.
Follow-up. So it's going to take 60 days to review this. That's going to put the whole project on hold, obviously, for 60 days. That's not – am I right doing that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it doesn't put the project on hold. The project, if you want to call it that, is an order to fix something. So basically, from the landowner's perspective, it gives them some time to work it out to make sure that what they've been ordered to do is, in fact, accurate. So it would give them some relief, if you will, of having to follow an enforcement order while some findings are made to make sure it's correct.
Senator Chaudhry?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaski, is it true that the only substantive change with this is that someone would be able to read it in statute now as opposed to just the rules?
Mr. Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, that's correct.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
We on to a new subject yet, Mr. Chair?
Further questions, or if anyone else would like to testify in opposition to this language, we're welcoming you to the table at this time.
I'm sure I did have a question for Mr. Jaski.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think you were going to move the bill.
No, I was going to ask. If we were done with this line of questioning.
Senator Dibble, to Mr. Jaski, then.
Well, I'm just going back to page one, and I was, can you explain that again, Mr. Jaski?
Why,
seems to me we already have provisions for replacing wetlands and find enough wetland, or if there's too much wetland in a given area, we already have provisions for citing the replacements elsewhere, even around the entire state. So just give it to me one more time here.
Mr. Jaski?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, yes. You're correct. There are statutes and rules that govern that. The unique thing that this language addresses are that mining projects are operated totally differently under the State Wetland Conservation Act than others. They are operated under the DNR's permit to mine. The DNR authorizes wetland impacts if they need to occur under the same standards, and they then require mitigation to be accomplished to offset that. But that happens under a multi-year, sometimes decades-long process. And so it really operates like our wetland banking system does if it weren't for a mining project, okay? And so that's the main reason. Of course, the second reason that we're talking about this specific change is that those mining companies happen to reside right on that boundary of the Continental Divide, right? And some of their projects, actually, some parts of them drain one way and some the other. And so you end up with a situation where some flexibility is warranted because we want them to replace the impacts as close as possible rather than if you look at this one, if part of the project was in the area too, we would prefer them to do it closer than having to go further away in that same basin. And so that's the practical response I would have to this language, is just to allow them to be as close as possible to the site where the impact occurs and to do that under the DNR's permit to mining authority.
Follow up.
Thanks. Well, that sounds great. I agree. It should be closer. It sounds like, though, it's allowing them to be farther away. It makes me just a little nervous in light of the letter from the Department of Interior to the Army Corps of Engineers that was also, I mean, we talked a lot about the EPA letter, but the Interior letter to the Army Corps was pretty critical on the grounds of this whole wetland replacement issue with the PolyMet proposal. So just, I'm just worried about opening up a can of worms here that we might not want to open up on this replacement issue with all these new mines that are coming online.
Let's take
okay.
Ms. Wolf.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Allison Wolf. I'm with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Briefly, I know time is short. We would raise concerns about the proposed amendment. It surprised us to have this coming in at this late time, given the long time, you know, the long time for planning these mining projects. And it's no surprise to this committee that there's been a lot of time invested in planning those projects and evaluating them. We support the watershed approach, which has been confirmed and affirmed by the PCA and the EPA as the best way to make these wetland mitigation decisions. And we think that the watershed approach should be flexible enough to accommodate different problems, such as these border issues when projects are large enough to be on a border between two watersheds. I would say, however, that I have just confirmed with the Army Corps of Engineers that this would be the largest wetland destruction permit in the state history, speaking specifically now for the PolyMet project that is planned. And given the size of that wetland loss, I'm just not comfortable having us do this on the fly and feeling that this is, as I said, coming in late as a House committee amendment late Thursday, and now all of us trying to get our brains around it at this point. So I would just say that with the largest wetland loss in state history being considered, I would encourage you to view this in that light. I also am getting information from the lawyers in my office that they feel that current statute and rules may be flexible enough to accommodate this kind of problem when it comes up during the course of the DNR's administration of the Wetland Conservation Act under the permit to mine. But since that is a different way of administering WACA than most of us are familiar with, and having DNR be the agency that's doing that instead of Bowser, I think it you know, that's another thing that, that maybe would be something good to take a deeper look at in a hearing at some point. So we just wanted to raise our concerns about that, given the extensive wetland loss that's being discussed.
Questions for Ms. Wolf? Seeing none, is there anyone else that would like to share?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you testify.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer with Larkin Hoffman. I represent the Statewide Builders Association as well as the Twin Cities Builders Association here at the Capitol. And in my law practice, I represent developers and builders around the state of Minnesota on issues of the sort that are before you. I only have one comment, which we've been talking with the Bowser folks about. It's on page 3. It's the very last sentence that begins at line 3.20 and then carries over to the very next line. We think that that provision essentially opens up the so-called 60-day rule to a new appeal process time frame. They disagree, respectfully. We've agreed, for the sake of trying to work with them on this, that there may be a better way to fix this language than is currently provided in the bill. And so I want to note the objection to the language in its current form, because we think it creates an exception that's not intended by the legislature. But we've also committed to them that we'll work with them on alternative language that accomplishes their objectives of managing an appeal process efficiently without putting the developer, the applicant, the building officials, you know, basically under a new open-ended time frame that affects the development schedule that they're trying to work with. So those are my comments, and if Mr. Jaski thinks I've misstated something that we've agreed on, I certainly don't want to misstate anything here.
Mr. Jaski, does that sound like something you've discussed with Mr. Coyle?
Mr. Coyle, prepared it correctly.
Questions? Senator Chaudhry.
Yeah. This is what I'd like to do. It's kind of weird, but I think I'd like to think about the mining thing more. I don't have a problem with what the A1 has in it, because I can see what they're saying. If you look at, you know, if you look at, just say this pointy part right up here in Basin 2, certain areas in Basin 1 right over the border are closer than something way up near Lake of the Woods. So that's what Mr. Jaski is saying. But this, I think this amendment was just put on the House bill on Thursday, and I don't think there's been a lot of vetting. And I don't have an opinion either way. But I would like, just because we had a very high-profile discussion on this, I'd like a little bit more information and just keep this bill moving. And and the House still has theirs in their bill, so that will keep moving and match up eventually, and that'll give us time to talk about this. So at the appropriate time, I will make a motion, having voted on the prevailing side, to reconsider the A1.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, could that be accomplished if you added language to the effect that if this if this combination, or however you want to do it, right word for it, would accommodate a closer proximity of the replacement wetlands to the affected site?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it might not. I'm just not sure, and I'm not prepared to figure it out right now. That's a good suggestion to take into consideration.
So, Chaudhry, if you'd like to make the motion.
I'll move, having voted on the prevailing side, I move to reconsider the A1.
Senator Chaudhry is moving to reconsider. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails.
I'll withdraw the A1 and move that Senate file 3210 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Questions?
Is that the only difference?
To the Chaudhry motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
All.
Motion prevails.
I think that's it, Mr. Chair. We'll keep talking about this.
End of this business.